Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Harlan Levy. Today I'll be reading from the June 17th issue of the New Yorker magazine. The article is titled Screen Grab by Gia Tolentino. Two small children jumped into a bubble bath with expressions of dazed perpetual pleasure. Music plays, a mixture of giggles and xylophone, with a tune you remember and words you don't. White bubble balls appear all over the hands of the children. The children, once clean, materialize outside the bathtub and do a happy dance. This is Bath Song, a 2-minute and 52-second video produced by the children's animation juggernaut, Coco Melon. In the world of babies and toddlers who watch a lot of YouTube, Bath Song is Star Wars, the moon landing, the white Bronco hurtling across a California freeway. It was uploaded in 2018 and is now the fourth most viewed video on the entire platform. It has been watched nearly 7 billion times. Very young children are crazy for Coco Melon. The swirly-haired baby is called JJ. He has two older siblings, smiling parents who are endlessly available to make rainbow popsicles, and a diverse group of friends who attend Melon Patch Academy under the tutelage of the youthful Miss Appleberry. The scenes are depicted from toddler height. Shots typically change every 1 to 3 seconds. All shapes are rounded at the corners. There are no sharp edges anywhere, so that nothing in Coco Melon can hurt. What's heaven to babies? Plugging one's mouth with silicone, sleeping with one's limbs bound. Coco Melon is the stuff of padded rooms to parents. Sitting through even a second of Coco Melon as an adult is roughly equivalent to spending 1,000 years being tortured with red-hot pokers in an echo chamber that has been filled with vomit and malfunctioning smoke detectors, a columnist for The Guardian wrote recently. The candy store music, the ultra-synthetic animation, the mixture of slow, bobbing movement and relentless editing. Watch it for more than a few minutes and you'll feel like you're hallucinating. JJ has only 2 teeth, but he knows the alphabet and plays soccer. What sort of baby is this? In small children, screen time tends to induce a cycle of fervor, placidity, and withdrawal. Parents on social media refer to Coco Melon zombies and Cocaine Melon, and a small number of them have fearfully speculated that Coco Melon is a direct cause of developmental differences and delays. In fact, many parents of neurodivergent kids use Coco Melon fixation as a way of engaging their children with simple social scripts. Here's what happens at the doctor. Here's how we get into our car seat. The first time I took my daughter to the dentist at 18 months old, she was apoplectic. I turned on Coco Melon, and she instantly relaxed, happy to lie back in my arms in the big chair. Television has long played babysitter. In 1948, when WABD in New York became the first American station to regularly offer full daytime programming, it issued a press release. The schedule has been designed to coincide with the average housewife's routine, the station announced. When the housewife has to wash the breakfast dishes or fix luncheon, for instance, there will be programs designed to keep preschool children occupied and out of her way. Now such programs are available at all hours, which is how often we need them. These days, each of us watches a personal screen that presents the things an algorithm has decided will best hold our attention. Kids are inducted into this lifestyle as toddlers. By 2020, nearly half of 2 to 4-year-olds in the United States had their own electronic devices. On YouTube, the attention of small children became a seam of glittering gold for content creators to mine. Some of what has resulted, Miss Rachel, for instance, a streaming personality whose videos are like FaceTimes with a magical preschool teacher, is thoughtful and playful. Some of it is hypnotic. 2-hour streams from the point of view of a train conductor chugging through the lush Welsh countryside, or the ubiquitous videos of disembodied hands opening toy eggs. And some of it is sinister. knockoff Paw Patrol face swap videos, or awful cartoons in which a pregnant, off-brand Minnie Mouse might have a baby who steps on nails and cries. Then there is the endless array of programs that seem troublingly habit-forming, but otherwise basically harmless. Five-year-old influencers who chat about toys, videos that feature inane play-acting with popular dolls, and the various animated nursery rhyme channels of which Cocomelon is king. Many parents end up settling on this last option when handing iPads to their toddlers, sometimes with a nagging thought or two in the back of their minds. Who actually makes this stuff, and with what degree of care? Is it all generated by computers following the dictates of some algorithm? Would it matter if it were? Cocomelon releases its videos in 25 languages, including American Sign Language, and they are distributed on dozens of streaming services around the world. Cocomelon Lane, a Netflix spinoff that ages the Cocomelon babies up to inquisitive talking toddlers, is on its second season. There are Cocomelon live events, Cocomelon merchandise, and a Cocomelon podcast. A feature-length film is in the works. According to Nielsen, Cocomelon has been streamed on Netflix for more than 30 billion minutes each year for the past 3 years, even as it remains basically unknown to most people who have not semi-recently changed a diaper. It has become one of the most successful entertainment franchises of all time. What is now the main Cocomelon YouTube channel was created in 2006 by Korean immigrant couple in Los Angeles, Jay Jeon, a commercial director, and his wife. For years, even after the channel became hugely popular, their identities were a mystery. In 2020, shortly before selling Cocomelon to a company called Moonbug, Jeon gave an interview to Bloomberg. He said that his wife had worked as a children's book author, but asked that her name not be published. He has since retreated into privacy again and did not respond to requests for an interview. Jeon and his wife started out by making animated shorts, 90 seconds long, colorful and clumsy, to amuse their kids. Beethoven's Fifth playing over a ladybug landing on a lion's nose, say, in a video about the letter L. The YouTube channel soon generated enough ad revenue for the couple to quit their day jobs and hire a small team of employees. In 2015, the videos began featuring children. Then the animation switched from a hand-drawn look to slick 3D, and JJ appeared. YouTube's algorithm buoyed the channel with unprecedented force during 2 months in 2017. Monthly views doubled to 238 million. A year later, Cocomelon was getting 2 billion monthly views. 2 years after that, the channel was averaging more than 100 million viewers every day. Moonbug was founded in London in 2018 with the aim of acquiring and expanding viral YouTube children's channels. It rapidly grew the Cocomelon franchise. Soon, Cocomelon was the second most streamed program on that platform, and its most popular show among Black, Asian, and Hispanic audiences in the U.S. In 2021, two longtime Disney executives, Kevin Mayer and Tom Staggs, created a next-generation media company called Candle Media, with backing from the private equity firm Blackstone. Among its first purchases was Moonbug, which it acquired for a reported $3 billion. Moonbug has nearly 500 employees and 29 children's media properties and are produced in many different countries. Cocomelon, by far its most successful, is headquartered in the company's Los Angeles office, which is situated among a row of upscale chain storefronts near the Grove. At the entrance, a chalk sign proclaimed, "Welcome to Moonbug," above the slogan, "Learn, Laugh, Grow." Inside, there was a rack of Cocomelon toys in the reception area and, on the wall, collages of adorable fan art mailed to the company by kids. Otherwise, the place looked like any creative class content factory, an open-plan maze of people with monitors and headphones, radiating efficiency and a desire to go to lunch. I was ushered into a conference room where I spent the next 5 hours being pleasantly precision-targeted by a choreographed series of presentations and interviews. The chief creative officer at Moonbug, Richard Hickey, previously worked as a director in both children's television and advertising. He and Andy Yateman, the company's managing director for the Americas and a former Netflix Kids executive, spoke like pitch decks. Moonbug's mission, they said, was to empower kids all over the world with essential life skills. The company did this by acquiring IP with reach and audience, which displayed core values of compassion, empathy, and resilience. We were joined by two creative executives, Megan Sheridan and Jasmine Johnson, and I peppered them with questions. How old is JJ supposed to be? The kids' ages stretch to reflect both the reality and the aspiration of their audience's lives, they said. I asked about JJ's parents, his teacher, the town where Cocomelon is set. There were answers to many of my questions in roughly 100-page show Bible, a guide for the staff to Cocomelon lore. I wondered aloud about how the company handled the nuances of being in the business of children's attention. For a profit-driven enterprise in the streaming era, all-day binges were probably the ideal mode of consumption. We want kids to watch it for a little while, but the rest of the day should be filled up with exercise and interaction, Hickey said. It was up to caregivers and parents to regulate screen time, he added. Moonbug's job was to create a safe place on that screen. I'd read an article in The Times in which researchers at Moonbug observe a young child who'd been placed in front of two screens. One screen played a Moonbug show, and the other, called the Distractatron, played footage of everyday adult life. Each time the child looked away from the Moonbug screen toward the Distractatron, the researcher made a note. Time to tweak the episode. Did the company really design its shows so that kids would never look away? Hickey and Yateman said that the Distractatron was the work of a third-party research company, and that neither of them had even heard that word before the article was published. Such attentional calculations were not part of their process, Hickey told me, adding, we use data in creative retrospectively. Johnson mentioned an episode called Hair Wash Day, in which a black mother washes and styles her son's hair. She said it was particularly meaningful to her that an episode authentically depicted bath time routines for a black family. Later, Natasha Crandall, an educational consultant, told me that she and others reviewed early versions of episodes and suggested careful improvements. If a scene showed a kid juggling apples, she'd scratch that. It might impart the accidental takeaway that food was meant to be played with. Also, it wouldn't be appropriate, she said, given that some in the show's audience might be food insecure. After lunch, a few members of the music team arrived, an appealingly earnest crew of Berkeley graduates. They were led by Eric Calver, a 30-something who comes from a family of children's entertainers. My father's a magician, and my mother was a clown, he said. The team workshopped a new song about kids playing with pots and pans in front of me, adjusting chord structures on the fly, adding flourishes on the ukulele and on the drums. Calver said that they would probably sample forks and knives as percussion, and add them to the usual xylophones, marimbas, glockenspiels, woodwinds, and laughter. The learning takeaway of this episode was clear. Moonbug was a spontaneous, creative place, telling stories with passion and love. A few months before my visit, the company had laid off about 30 people, including most of the Cocomelon writers, and much of its in-house animation team. Bloomberg reported that Moonbug planned to experiment with artificial intelligence. I asked Hickey about this. He told me that Moonbug would continue to look at what the technology is and where the benefit is for raising the bar creatively, but that there was zero AI at work in Cocomelon currently. Some of the fears regarding Cocomelon and its ilk are not new. Socrates, in Plato's Republic, asks, shall we just carelessly allow children to hear any casual tales which may be devised by casual persons, and to receive into their minds ideas, for the most part, the very opposite of those which we should wish them to have when they are grown up? Mass media made exposure to tales seem less controllable than ever. In 1935, one parenting expert lamented the radio, saying, "No locks will keep this intruder out, nor can parents shut their children in away from it." Sesame Street arrived at the end of the 60s, and though it was hailed as a benchmark in quality programming, some observers speculated that its fast pace would leave kids overstimulated and malcontent. By the end of the 80s, preschool-aged children were already watching TV about as much as they currently watch screens, around 30 hours per week. But Cocomelon's core viewership is not preschool age. It's pre-preschool age. I've been in kids' TV for a super, super long time. Susan Kim, a writer in the industry, told me, "It used to be that there were certain things you couldn't say, or you'd be rebuked in the room." Kim, who's written for Cocomelon Lane, worked on Square One in the 1980s, Thomas and Friends in the 90s, and Arthur in the 2000s, among many other programs. "For one, you weren't allowed to say that anything was for 1 to 2 year olds, she said. "I think everyone had the sense, whether or not they'd actually read the white papers on it, that children that young should not be planted in front of video and left alone." That began to change in the late 90s. Teletubbies, the psychedelic British kid show featuring colorful alien baby creatures, began airing in 1997. PBS imported it and marketed it toward children as young as 1. Around the same time, the company Baby Einstein started producing videos of puppets and patterns set to classical music. A few years later, HBO produced Classical Baby, a soothing Peabody-winning anthology series featuring a cartoon baby who conducts an all-animal orchestra that plays Aaron Copland and Eric Satie. These shows inspired controversy in their time, but they were gentle and calm, with the vibes of a peaceful, edifying, possibly stoned afternoon. Even so, when the American Academy of Pediatrics issued its first screen time guidelines in 1999, it recommended that kids under 2 avoid TV altogether. These guidelines were revised in 2016. The AAP now holds that children under 18 months can benefit from video chatting, and that kids aged 2 to 4 can learn from high-quality educational shows. It suggests that they avoid nursery rhyme channels, fast-paced shows, and YouTube on autoplay. Research has repeatedly documented connections between early prolonged exposure to television and worse outcomes later in life, language delays, problems with attention, and self-regulation. But many of these relationships are likely to be correlational or interactive, not causal. Parents who have less money and fewer enrichment opportunities, or who are racially marginalized, or who struggle with their mental health, frequently overlapping factors, tend to have kids who watch more television. If you can't afford childcare or a lot of toys, screen time is always available as a babysitter and a treat. The people who create Cocomelon might value education, but the metric that would determine Moonbug's profitability was time on screen. Radesky suggested that the company's priorities were apparent in the way it presented its content. Just the fact that the compilations are marked 30 minutes, 60 minutes, they know these products are filling a gap created by parents being overworked, not having family leave, who are so stressed that they need to occupy their children for a certain amount of time, she said. These systemic issues may help explain why, on Netflix, in the U.S., Cocomelon is particularly popular with non-white viewers. In 2020, according to an annual survey by the nonprofit Common Sense Media, white children aged 8 and under used mobile devices for an average of 37 minutes a day. That year, black children of the same age used mobile devices for more than 100 minutes a day. Jeffa Krieg worked in Moonbug's London office in 2021 and 22. She was part of a team of about 30 people who repackaged the company's videos into compilations in order to generate more views and more ad revenue. Previously, Krieg had worked as a preschool teacher and she'd got the impression that kids who watched hours of Cocomelon every day had a hard time regulating their emotions. But she wanted to get into online media. She's now a channel manager for a digital content studio. And Moonbug had a mission of creating educational resources, which sounded great. Her point of view changed once she started working there. I think they have an excellent PR team who know all the buzzwords to make it feel like they're making excellent, culturally relevant educational content, she told me. And then they've got 37 people in the back room making 15 different combinations of the same 10 songs over and over. As part of her job, Krieg would keep an eye on traffic. If a video with a thumbnail image of a certain dog got a lot of views, she'd make a bunch of thumbnails featuring that dog. At first, she said, the compilations were mostly 15 or 30 minutes long. Then we were like, oh, the 30-minute ones are doing really well. Let's try 60 minutes. Those are doing really well. Let's try 90. After I visited the Moonbug office in Los Angeles, I looked up some of the company's ex-employees on LinkedIn. I found a post from Cocomelon's former head writer, written last fall, announcing the good news that he and his wife had welcomed their second child, and the bad news that he'd been laid off 4 days before the birth. I ended up speaking to 10 people who had worked on Cocomelon or associated properties at various points between 2020 and 2023. Most of them requested anonymity. Some had signed non-disclosure agreements. Others feared professional reprisal. Those who had worked in the L.A. office described it as a chaotic, micromanaged, and morale-depleting place. More broadly, they voiced complaints that echoed what Krieg, the former London employee, had suggested, that the company's stated commitments to education and cultural relevance, including diversity, primarily existed as a rationalization for harnessing the maximum amount of attention from young children around the world. Usually, in children's television, the audience comes first, one ex-employee, who'd also worked at multiple major networks, told me. At Moonbug, revenue and analytics is first, audience second. A lot of parents, harangued by a toddler, will open YouTube and search the word train. To fulfill this content need, a 21-year-old assistant had co-written a song called Train Song, which eventually featured in an episode that now has more than a quarter of a billion views. Children's television has always been a commercial proposition. Even the ad-free Sesame Street has produced landfills worth of trademark merchandise. But Cocomelon's level of top-down engineering, creativity by way of search engine optimization, is atypical in children's TV. There was a Cocomelon master planning matrix that dictated the year's priorities, episode themes, the number of episodes starring each character. Another person described writing television for kids as a matter of balancing the reality principle, curricular points, story beats, the superego, notes from the network, and the id, the juice of the story, the things kids fear and love, the things that make them laugh. Writing for Moonbug, this person added, was 90% superego and maybe 8% reality principle, with hardly any room for the id. Cocomelon touts the diversity of its world. Of the 6 main child characters, one is black, one is Korean, and one is Mexican. Recently, the company took some culture war heat for an episode of Cocomelon Lane, in which Nico, one of the toddlers, puts on a tutu and dances around with his two dads. Nico's two dads had never been cleared to appear on the main Cocomelon YouTube channel. We just wanted to have his parents pick him up from school, and he has two dads, and that's it. They just exist, Quinn said. But it was always just like, well, if we do this, we really need to do it right. Maybe we'll want to bring in a consultant. Nina, the Mexican character, had initially been written as Puerto Rican, but two people told me that her ethnicity had been changed because higher-ups believed and said outright that a Mexican character would reach a bigger audience. Several people also brought up an incident from 2022 in which a white executive allegedly told the black executive, who was wearing her hair in locks, "If I'd have known you'd wear your hair like this, I wouldn't have hired you." Soon afterward, the black executive left the company with a settlement. Public records confirm a workers' compensation case in California filed by this former executive citing psychiatric damages. Public financial reports filed in the UK show Boonbug bringing in $35 million in gross profit in 2020, $100 million in 2021, and $165 million in 2022, the first year it turned a net profit. Cocomelon's streaming numbers are almost unfathomable. An internal email from the first quarter of 2023 shows that its quarterly YouTube streams were at more than 60 billion minutes. A few months before the October layoffs, employees noticed an atypical slowdown in production. Around that time, the writers were instructed to come up with an episode set in a Target store, which would be posted as sponsored content. Moonbug is the first major kids studio to use YouTube as a primary distribution platform, and most of its shows, unlike those which originate on Disney or Amazon or Netflix or Apple, are not unionized. Several people told me that the writer responsible for the five highest performing episodes of 2022 was making $75,000 a year when he got laid off in October. In December, Bloomberg reported that Candle was seeking to restructure its Blackstone debt, which ran to more than $1 billion. Moonbug, one former employee told me, was regarded as a cautionary tale by a lot of people in the animation industry, a sign of where the entire industry could go if left unchecked, without protections. When the former employees, described as micromanagement, struck me as an attempt to fine-tune the formula behind the show's extraordinary success and render it replicable, scalable, and defensible in perpetuity, a way to add billions of viewing minutes every year, cheaply, and for this to be considered a positive educational thing. But it's possible that the je ne sais Cocomelon is largely a matter of fortunate timing. The show came around just as YouTube was invented, and right before Apple released the iPad. The major animation studios were not producing shows for kids under two. When those children were handed personal electronic devices, the pristine land of their attention was wide open for amateurs to farm. This is not to say that Moonbug has not stewarded Cocomelon's success carefully. I asked everyone I talked to if there was any funny internal guidelines for the Cocomelon universe. There were, they said. For example, shots in which a kid was on a parent's shoulders were to be avoided because they would make it glaringly obvious how disproportionately large the kid's heads were. Three people also brought up an executive's dictum about endings. Even if an episode was soundtracked by a lullaby, the characters should not go to sleep at the end of it. If they did, kids at home might be encouraged to press pause and put the screen away. In April, I took my daughter, who will soon turn 4, to a live Cocomelon event in a hotel ballroom in Philadelphia. It featured a disco dance section, themed photo ops, crafts, and meet and greets with adults dressed as giant mascot-like versions of the show's characters. When we arrived at 10 in the morning, it was packed. The children, many of them in Cocomelon clothing, screamed with elation. The Cocomelon version of The Wheels on the Bus played over loudspeakers, and I had the uncanny feeling that something from deep inside my computer had breached the realm of the real. Even if Moonbug was not currently using AI to replace creative labor, some former employees told me, the writing seems to be on the wall. Jeffrey Katzenberg, a co-founder of DreamWorks, which is reportedly developing the Cocomelon movie, has suggested that 90% of animation work will someday be done by AI. There have been two more rounds of layoffs at Moonbug this year. Two people speculated that Candle Media was hoping to sell Moonbug to Disney, and that the company, having exhausted its growth mode options, was trying to engineer an attractive balance sheet for a sale. The best kids' TV feels very bespoke, Susan Kim told me. If you're a child, it feels like it was made for you. It feels intense and absorbing, imaginative and free, and wonderful, and scary, and funny. Recently, all four people in my household got the stomach flu simultaneously. We lay on the floor of the living room and watched Classical Baby on repeat, all 6 episodes, 3 times in a row. I felt delight, even then, and dimly recalled one of the conclusions about screen time, which is most strongly backed by research. The TV that is best for kids is whatever a parent will sit down and watch with them. The most frightening studies I've seen found that parents, when using smartphones, respond to their children's needs less, play with them less, and show decreased sensitivity and warmth. Parental device usage correlates strongly with children's device usage. The average adult spends some 4.5 hours each day looking at her phone. When it comes to the shows we allow our children to watch, we are afraid of what exactly? That our kids' capacity for deep thought will be blunted by compulsive screen use? That they'll lose their ability to sit with the plain fact of existence? To pay attention to the world as it is? To conceive of new possibilities? That they'll grow up to be just like us, only worse? At the ballroom in Philadelphia, after a bubbly pigtailed performer let the kids through a round of the chicken dance, the enormous mascot versions of J.J. and Cody came out, their heads bigger than beach balls. Everyone ran toward them as if Taylor Swift and Beyoncé had just emerged in our midst. My daughter, suddenly self-conscious, shrank into herself. Still, when it was time to leave, she was inconsolable. We had to get on a bus, to a train, to a subway, to another subway, and it was becoming a whole scene, us in the hotel lobby. I pulled out her tablet and her headphones and tuned on Finding Nemo, a movie made by an enormous corporation about a parent who tries unsuccessfully to protect his son from the beautiful, overwhelming, treacherous world. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I'm Harlan Levy, and I've been reading from the June 17th issue of the New Yorker magazine. So long, until next time.